Welcome to the Daily French Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Hello, hello, everyone, and welcome to another week of the Daily French Show. Another wonderful week in South Africa as we grapple with the many scandals, stories, and all that good stuff that we deal with here on this show. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, and I'm going to be joined today by the Ministry of Truth Fellows, that is Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you this morning?
Good, Nick, and yourself?
I'm very good, thank you. And Mr. Marius Ruart. Marius, how are you?
Hello, comrades. Nice to see you guys.
It's very appropriate that you say that, because our first story today, and you may have gotten from the headline, is that apparently, according to Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma, our overlord during the height of the lockdown, the enemy operates amongst us. What am I talking about? Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma gave a speech to the Young Communist League at WITS, that was on the Chris Hani Memorial Lecture on Saturday, and the title of this of the lecture was "Saving the Soul of the ANC from the Claws of Factionalism and Neoliberal Policies." Now, this lecture has been published in full on IOL, which is well known as the kind of mouthpiece of the Zuma faction. And I suggest if you're interested in kind of getting an idea of where the ANC's headspaces ideologically, you should go check out that entire lecture. It's quite long, but she goes through a number of things. She talks about, she says that the ANC's view is that despite the gains recorded by what she calls the developmental democratic state, the tyranny of the market has gained gravitas. She goes on to say that this was noted by the ANC conference, and that despite the economic advances, the legacies of colonialism and apartheid are still deeply entrenched. She talks about the need to decolonize education. She says a whole number of things, lots of praise for characters such as Che Guevara and Engels. But here's the quote that I think got put in the headline and stands out to a lot of us, which is, "This phase of our revolution is perhaps most testing, as the enemy is now unseen and operates amongst us, persuading some to abandon the revolutionary spirit of the Congress movement. However, as you enter into this battle, remember what Comrade Chris Hani said, what Comrade Che Guevara said. The revolution is made by man, but man must forge his revolutionary spirit from day to day." She concludes it with a quote from a letter from Frederick Engels to Adolf Sorge, the day after Karl Marx died, where he says in the letter, "The struggle of the proletariat continues. That victory is certain." So, a lot of ANC ideology. Let me start with you, Morris. What do you make of this phrase, "The enemy is now unseen and operates amongst us"? It's got a very ominous ring to it, and I must say I don't really like it in a democratic context.
I'm not sure what that means. I mean, does she mean that the ANC is being infiltrated by, you know, these terrible neoliberals or something, or people who think that the market maybe isn't a bad thing? I mean, I really don't know what it means, but also I agree with you. I don't like this use of the word enemy to describe people that disagree with you in a democratic country. Like, the DA and the EFF aren't the ANC's enemies, they're their opponents. And I mean, that's also one of the problems I have actually with the EFF, that they brought this kind of war talk into the mainstream. But I mean, that also comes partly from the ANC. The EFF and the ANC are still pretty close, I think. So, but I mean, all this kind of rhetoric, it could have been cut and paste from a document from some, party from the fighting against colonization in the 1960s and just about anywhere in Africa. You know, it's like really this kind of really backwards looking way of, and it also, the ANC talks about being, about the revolution and so on. I mean, they've been in charge for 27 years. They shouldn't be talking about a revolution. They've had complete control of the politically of the country for, I mean, basically a generation. So, you know, this continued talk about revolutions and being revolutionaries is like, you guys aren't revolutionaries. You're the establishment, which is fine. But then stop claiming that you're revolutionaries and whatever the case is. But there was one also telling line here that we just mentioned before we started podcasting here. So she says, so what must be done? We must therefore deconcentrate economic and work opportunities away from the state, at least at local level. For so long as the rural child in Winnie Marquisela Mandela municipality in the Eastern Cape only sees the municipal manager or the mayor as the most successful person in the area, then services itself will thrive. We must create economic opportunities where the people live as anticipated by the RDP. So you think, I mean, that's actually... So, like, that's actually quite a heartening thing to say. She's like, you know, the state isn't the one that must be creating jobs and so on. But then she finishes the paragraph by saying this: to facilitate for this and also inculcate the culture of long-term planning, we are currently implementing the district development model, which is basically, you know, this a bureaucrat in Pretoria will be telling somebody who lives in, you know, Mbazana in the Eastern Cape, this is, you know, this is a factory you must build. These are how many people you must employ and so on. So it's like almost, it's almost as if, you know, some sense wants to break through, but there's this ANC kind of immunity to it. You know, I think they've taken a vaccine against economic right. good sense. I don't know. You know, so.
so there's also a bit in the speech where she talks about the need for a strong, efficient state and a patriotic private sector, which is such a loaded term that I think speaks very ill of how the ANC views the private sector. Although, to be fair, at least she's not calling for full nationalization of the economy. No, not yet, at least. Anyway, Terence, what do you make of this whole speech and this line in particular? Some will say, oh, this is just the Zuma faction, this is not Cyril, but I think that we probably all agree that this is a more honest reflection of the ANC's ideological center than perhaps the rhetoric that Cyril sometimes says at business forums.
I'm not sure that there's a huge difference, really. That if you take out the rhetorical flourishes and the references to Che Guevara, you know, Ramaphosa is also on record with his protestations of the beauties of socialism and things like that. Secondly, the idea of a statist path to the economic future, I think that's universal in the ANC. The private sector, you know, whether you want to call it, you know, patriotic or not, or you know, highlight or downplay its contribution. At the end of the day, what the ruling party has taught, you know, has in mind is this omniscient, benevolent, developmental state that will discipline capital, and you know, lead us to the great sunlit uplands. No, look, it's stuck in the past. It's nostalgic more than anything, I think. And maybe that's not entirely surprising, given that this is homage to Chris Harney, who I think has been kind of ripped out of whatever contextual reality he existed in, and has been held up as the sort of you know, what would have been for South Africa, because there's no way he would have been corrupt or whatever, and you know, it would have been so much better. And I've seen this again and again and again. Well, we really have no way of knowing. He was never put to that sort of test.
Right. Now, I spoke to my father this morning about this, and he said they really have not moved beyond Moscow.
Yeah,
and it's true. That's still the ideological center of the universe for many in the ANC.
Look, just sort of put this into perspective. We have had 2.5 decades of the ANC. They inherited a massive problem, and I think, you know, for you know, maybe that first decade, you could you could cut them a great deal of slack. I think that during Mbeki's presidency, in some ways, they started to make progress. But you know, as far as this rhetoric about enemies goes, one of the most chilling documents to come out of post-apartheid South Africa was something Mbeki himself wrote: "The enemy maneuvers, but it remains the enemy." you look at ANC documents from the 1990s, they, you know, they talk about Nelson Mandela's speech at the 1997 conference in Mafeking. This paranoid fixation that there is this enemy out to get them, which they explicitly said in some instances, you know, includes people who operate legally. You know, it wasn't enough to be loyal to the constitution or the flag or whatever. You know, it was seeking to displace the people. I mean, this is the, you know, the idea of Jacobin democracy. But we made progress for, you know, for the first 10 to 13 years. And I think we've gone backwards. Let's put that into perspective. The Korean War ended in 1953. Korea was absolutely devastated. Yes, they got aid, and yes, they had access to American markets, which was as much of a national security as an economic thing. But by 1978, the equivalent period of time, South Korea was starting to crest the world with a number of PhDs. You know, they went from a country whose economy was based on guano and bird feathers, you know, to one that was producing high quality consumer electronics and
ships as well.
And ships, yeah. We talk about the developmental state. Well, you know, in South Korea, that's sort of what you had. Industrial policy played a big part, overseen by a civil service that knew what it was doing, that employed its best and its brightest. Yeah, lots of corruption, whatever. But, you know, it greased the wheels as opposed to stealing the wheels. Now, in South Africa, how many of those rural municipalities are even functional? Just at a minimal level that can get you your water and electricity. Secondly, you know, whereas the Koreans could stress by not having enough PhDs, even though they were, as I say, right up there in the world by that time, we worry about school leavers not being able to read and write. Could there be something other than these dreadful neoliberals sneaking around and infiltrating and, you know, hiding under your bed at night?
Right. No, exactly. I think one should take the statistics that come out of the People's Republic of China quite with a grain of salt. But it's pretty clear that there's been some kind of massive transformation. By the official statistics, they've reduced absolute poverty from being 2/3 of their population in about 1990 to being, you know, less than 1% today. So that's almost an equivalent timescale, right? And China's done this amazing thing. And India is also now making extraordinary progress on that, despite COVID and all these other things. So I think when people say, you know, defenders of the ANC say it hasn't had enough time. Well, I'm not sure about that. Marius, any final thoughts on this before we move on?
No, I just want to say I think it's good that you mentioned India too, because South Korea, when it did quite well, it wasn't democracy as far as I know. Not in the true sense of the term, and China obviously isn't. So, and Vietnam's also done similarly in reducing poverty, and that's also, I mean, it's a one-party state. You know, there's no real freedom of speech in Vietnam. But then I think it's important to point at India, which is, definitely has its fair share of problems now, but it's still kind of a democracy, even given with what Narendra Modi's been doing. I mean, there's some worrying things coming out of India, but I think it's just important to know that a country can also be democratic and fight and reduce poverty significantly. And right. We've seen that in a number of other places, Eastern Europe especially, we've seen that kind of thing happen. So, yeah, democracy and economic development can definitely happen together.
Right. Now, I think Indonesia is also actually kind of an example of that. So it is a dysfunctional democracy. I'm not going to tell you that it's a well-functioning free society. But it's having pretty good economic growth despite this incredible dysfunction. And it shows that if you just get some of the basics right, like, for example, not viewing capital as the enemy that needs to be disciplined, you're probably going to make a lot of progress, even without fixing
it. Malaysia, also a good example, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Anyway, check that out. It's on IOL. I forgot to say at the beginning of the show that, of course, we know about the big fire that's raging across Cape Town. I think it's still burning as we're talking now. And a lot of UCT has unfortunately been caught in the blaze, as far as we can tell. We're going to cover that story later in this week when more details emerge. I know there was a report that someone had been arrested for setting fires on Table Mountain. It's not clear how all of this is connected, so we're going to wait for more details to come out before we talk about that. All right. With that out of the way, let us move on to our next story, and this is about South Africa's favorite politician, former Nelson Mandela Bay councillor Andile Lungisa, who was found guilty by a court of smashing a heavy glass jug over the head of a DA councillor during a council meeting. He was found guilty of assault, and he was sentenced to a time in prison. I can't remember how much it was. I think it was 2 years or something. And he managed to get out on parole after about a month, mysteriously. He was also carried into the prison by his ANC comrades on their shoulders while they sang songs of lament. But he doesn't appear to stay in there very long. So a miscarriage of justice, as far as I'm concerned. However, the DA councillor, which is Reyno Kayser, actually took him to court and sued him in his personal capacity for damages. And the court has now awarded Councillor Kayser 844,000 rand in damages for the assault that Lungisa committed. Lungisa responded on social media that they can take my cats. I only own two cats. That's all they can have for me. So
he's an animal lover, which is nice.
Apparently. Although he's willing to give them away. So how much does he need? Terrence, the story is a mess, but at least it looks like the court is now putting another sanction on him. Well, of course, now they have to actually get the money. What do you make of this story?
Well, look, I'd just first like to make an observation that carrying someone into prison, doesn't that just seem like a distillation of everything that is dystopian about South Africa? But, you know, just work that one out for yourself. Carrying into prison, not carrying out of prison. What do I see beyond that? It's good that that he seems to have been given a severe reprimand by the court. Whether that will be enforceable, I'm not sure. I think that although they are under intense pressure, it is not so much our formal systems that where our problems lie. It is the way that they the culture that should to which they should be the backstop is failing. So yes, you are carrying someone into prison. He stays, I think it was 2 months. So, got another month of a 2-year sentence. Does the name Tony Ngeni mean anything to you? Remember that according to a little Google search I did, Mr. Lungisa was also in hot water some time ago for using racist invective against the governor of the Reserve Bank, including the word that dare not speak its name. Apparently, he apologized for that. But evidently there's one rule for for Andile Lungisa, and other rules for certain other people, including in comparable circumstances, certain administrators of certain London-based universities.
Right.
I don't know. This is the sort of thing that really does make me despair. One of those water jugs is big and heavy, and you bring it down with enough force in someone, you can kill him. Yet this is something where not only is this guy being able to, in the criminal system, to kind of walk between the raindrops, but he assumes he's going to be able to do it in the civil system as well. I do hope that there is some line drawn somewhere, although, to be honest, I'm not going to hold my breath.
Right. I mean, can you imagine if I don't know, David Mania or something from the DA did something similar to an ANC minister? It would be the end of the universe. It would be a completely different thing. David Mania would be put in a cell and never see the light of day again.
Yeah, actually, here there is a little comparator. Late 1990s, one member of, if I remember, one member of the DP and one member of the National Party. Or no, hold on. I think it was a Nat and a guy from the ANC, but I remember both of them were white Afrikaans guys.
Johnny De Lange was the ANC guy.
Yes, that's correct.
He was Deputy Minister of Justice for a time, I think.
Right. They had this altercation on the floor. One guy came and planted the other one, and then they kind of went fisticuffs. Fingonwala, I think, suspended them both for a couple of days. Now, this was, it was just a bit of bare-knuckle boxing, and it was more a breach of decorum than anything. But at least at that stage, there was some sort of consequence for it. That, you know, you don't just go and plant the oak a shot, you know, because he was checking you skier for whatever. Now, it was, you know, this is criminal assault with a potentially deadly weapon. I mean, that's bizarre.
I agree. Maurice, anything to add to what Terence has said? You had a good rant before the show. Recreate some of that.
As Terence says, it seems there's one rule for Andile Lungisa and different rule for others. But also, it's quite mind-boggling that the ANC hasn't expelled somebody like Lungisa, who, I mean, there's been rumors of corruption around him. I don't know if he's ever been found guilty or anything like that. But, I mean, as Terence says, he had assaulted somebody with a potential deadly weapon. And this isn't hearsay. It happened on camera. There are clips floating around of him hitting this poor guy in the head.
Guilty.
Exactly. So this isn't just hearsay or somebody says, yeah, about Andile, what he did. You know, he smashed somebody in the face, also in front of our evening counselors, 100 counselors and staff or whatever the case is. But as I was saying before, this shows, I mean, just thinking, just to disclaim, I didn't watch the funeral, but I've read about it. So this is talking about Prince Philip's funeral on the weekend. So as far as I can tell, all the COVID regulations were followed. They're like as the UK is at the moment for funerals, the Queen had to sit by herself. Nobody could sit around her and comfort her and so on. And I was thinking, this shows the difference in political culture between the UK and South Africa. We've seen at the heart of COVID, we saw, I think it was Andrew Mulangeni's funeral, was it? But anyway, somebody's funeral. And it was packed. People were not social distancing. People weren't wearing masks and whatever you think about the lockdown rules and so on. If you are representing the governing party, surely they would think about following the rules. Same as at the Zulu King's recent funeral. No, there was no social distancing, nothing like that. And I think it shows the difference, as I say, the difference in political culture, where the Queen has decided she needs to set an example, follow the rules as mandated by the government. Yeah, if it's an ANC person's funeral or somebody or an important South African royal such as the Zulu King, then the rules don't have to be followed. But we've seen other places where, you know, during lockdown, I saw weddings getting broken up. I saw there was a clip one time of some Muslim people who were praying when you weren't allowed to have gatherings, and the police came there and broke it up and said insulting things about... Exactly. So, you know, it's one thing to have these rules, but then everybody's got to follow them, whatever you think about the lockdown and all these different kinds of rules. So I think, as I say, that shows a difference in political culture. I mean, I don't think if you saw, I mean, in most other democracies, I don't think you'd see somebody who assaulted another person, potentially nearly killed them. In any other well-run party in any other democracy around the world, if they'd still be in that political party. And it tells you a lot about the ANC that Andile Lungisa is still actually one of the most prominent people in the ANC. And thank God for small mercies, but luckily he's not in cabinet yet, but who knows how long it'll be until he is.
Yeah, exactly. At least he did lose his seat as a councillor, but I think that's because it's illegal to be a councillor and be convicted of a serious crime. It's very telling about, I think, the general breakdown of the rule of law in South Africa. Right, let's move on to our last story for today, which is, of course, an announcement by President Cyril Ramaphosa of plans to expand the Port of Durban by significant degrees. So I think the Port of Durban is currently South Africa's biggest port. It does take a lot of cargo. Ramaphosa said that they were going to spend 100 billion rand over the next decade on the port, and they would aim on making it easier for more modern and larger ships to enter the port to be able to offload cargo and upgrade its capacity from about 2.9 million containers. That's how many it can handle at the moment. They want to upgrade it to 11 million containers. So that's a very big upgrade and quite ambitious. And we were talking a little bit before the show, you know, you can look at the story in two ways. One is that, you know, this is a good infrastructure project. South Africa's ports have been in need of upgrade for a long time. You know, this is something useful that government can do to actually, if it's going to spend money, this is a more useful thing to spend it on than most other things. But there's another side to this, which is, while some of the idea might be good, the devil is in the details. And as once again, my father cynically remarked, it's much easier to steal the money in KZN than if you built the port in Cape Town or something like that. So, Terence, what do you make of this upgrade? Do you think it's a good idea?
Well, what the president was doing, this was it was in his weekly letter, and he was sort of more, he wasn't announcing a new initiative, he was rather confirming that this is what they're busy with. Yeah, $100 billion, that's a lot of money. And there is a lot of scope for that to go awry. However, South Africa has a has an infrastructure deficit, and this is one that's been coming for a long, long time. When South Africa democratized in the 1990s, the ANC acknowledged that they were inheriting, as you know, one of the more positive legacies of the past, really well-developed infrastructure. A lot of that was ignored and not properly maintained for various reasons. The World Cup came around, there was a frenzy of sprucing up, and then it's been kind of left to decline again. At one stage, our ports, there was such concern about the delays in moving containers that South Africa was being kind of charged a surcharge for ships to dock. You know, you could clear cog. I forget the exact numbers, but it was like sort of 3 days or something, as opposed to a few hours in Singapore. Now, this unfortunately kind of reverberates through the economy. It's roads that have been allowed to crumble. It's a rail network that is, although quite extensive, is just not up to the task. It's a water infrastructure that's now nearing the end of its life. It's blackouts. It's Medusi, and unfortunately, the response then comes as the Medusis and Kusilis. You know, massive cost overruns and concerns about their viability. We've had we've had the same thing with water projects. The former premier of Gauteng, who went on to the water sector, you know, apparently had some explaining to do there. So in principle, yes, you know, these are upgrades we need. In practice, you know, I suspect that many of us are going to be very disappointed in the way that they're executed.
Indeed. Morris, any thoughts in 60 seconds?
Not really. I think Terence covered it, but I mean, we always get these announcements of these amazing mega infrastructure projects. I think it'd be interesting exercise for somebody to go through the various SONAs, State of the Nation addresses, going back, say, 20 years, and seeing what was announced by each president during the speech, and then seeing what was actually followed through and what wasn't. I think you'd be quite shocked, or not probably, you'd be probably quite unsurprised by what was announced and what was actually done. So, and I think this could well be likely just one of these where the president just throws in a good number, throws a dart at a map of South Africa. Cool, let's build, you know, something in Durban. Then he spins a thing with a number on it. Cool, 100 billion rand. Let's build 100 billion rand. And then another thing stops in Harbour. Could have been a 50 billion rand stadium in Bloemfontein, whatever, you know. So, and this is kind of it. I mean, hopefully, I mean, if the port needs to be upgraded, it needs to be upgraded. Hopefully it gets done properly. But yeah, I wouldn't hold my breath there.
Right. No, exactly. They need to actually do some of the basic maintenance on it first before they can start, I think, looking to these grander visions. But Morris, I think you may have cracked the code. I think you may have determined how President Ramaphosa creates an infrastructure project. He's got three dartboards.
Exactly.
He just takes
bullet trains. He's like, no, they'll never be bullet trains. Damn it. Oh, well.
Anyway, that's all the time we have for today. So thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed the show. Please check out the interview that we did as a special episode with Helen Ziller. It will be on the YouTube channel. It's called Helen Ziller on Wokeness. Me and Gabriel Krauser spoke to her about her new book. So that's pretty cool. And yeah, we'll see you tomorrow. Have a wonderful day. Cheers, everyone.